But while I have fingers to grasp a sword and eyes to see, your treacherous head is not safe on your shoulders, nor your daughter in her bed.
That, Dominic Sandbrook, was Genghis Khan, as played by John Wayne.
Tom, you definitely haven't had a stroke.
No, that was I thought that was yet another masterly impression. As I said, John Wayne playing Genghis Khan, the role he was born to play in the 1956 film The Conqueror. Have you seen it?
I haven't actually, Tom. I haven't done. And after that impersonation, I don't think I ever will.
It's basically a Western.
That's not how I imagined Genghis Khan sounding at all, let's be frank.
No. And I don't really imagine him looking like John Wayne either.
No, that's true. So I don't know who to blame there, the producers or you.
Anyway, so as listeners will probably have guessed, our theme today is Genghis Khan, or is that the correct way to pronounce it? Do you know what we need, Dominic, to advise us on this?
I do, but before we bring our expert in, Tom, I will just say this. We in The Rest Is History are not a podcast that does random shout-outs to schools across England. That is absolutely not our sort of modus operandi. However, if that school happens to be J.R.R. Tolkien's alma mater, and also the alma mater of our producer, Jack Davenport, then we take a very different line, don't we, Tom?
We might make an exception with that.
So this is a shout-out to the pupils at King Edward's Birmingham, Tom, who, it turns out, are great fans of The Rest Is History and are intending to listen to this episode in their classrooms.
Oh, that's wonderful. Wonderful.
Which all children, I think, nationwide should be doing, frankly.
Yes, yes. But I hope also that maybe there are some, I imagine they do drama at King Edward's Birmingham. So maybe
they will, yes.
Maybe that masterly opening will encourage some thespians to.
And I also have high hopes that this episode will play in schools across Mongolia as people get in touch with their. I don't think they're woke about their history there. So I think they absolutely will embrace the spirit of this podcast.
But not just Mongolia, the whole of Eurasia.
Well, that's
because
the thing,
that, of course,
isn't it?
Is our theme, isn't it?
It is.
Genghis Khan, the greatest conqueror of all time. Discuss.
So we were going to bring in an expert, weren't we? And do you have such a person?
I do. And he's very much a friend of the show. In fact, Dominic, he's the only person who has stepped into your shoes when you malingered
with
COVID. We welcomed to the show, not just, so he'd previously been a guest. He talked, did that brilliant episode on Persia. Then he stepped in to co-host with me the top 10 mistresses in history. And now he's back. It's the one and only Professor Ali Ansari, St. Andrews University. Ali, welcome back.
It's really good to be back.
You know, the peak best
Central Asian warlords I have known.
So Ali, Genghis Khan, not the correct pronunciation, right?
It isn't actually. Well, as far as we can tell, because actually the more accurate pronunciation or rendition seems to be, and I dare say among Persian historians of the Mongol period, and it's actually Genghis, it's a CH rather than a G. So it's people tend to agree that basically they have the nearest pronunciation or the
Persians did.
Yes, because
you're saying the Persians pronounced it better than the Mongols.
Yeah, Persian historians are really the ones that we can't do without, because a number of Persian historians, and one of them in particular, who I'll be quoting pretty liberally throughout here, was one of the ones who actually went to Karakorum and actually looked at the secret history and was actually invited to write a sort of an
early. So tell us about the secret history, because we should probably discuss the sort. I mean,
Tom, we're not a PhD. We should have a chapter on sources to start the podcast.
So you're going to be citing Persian sources, but the secret history is great, isn't it? Because that's
the secret
Mongolian
history is source. Great, but the only accounts we have, or the only sort of the only versions we have left, are actually taken from Chinese chronicles. So the Chinese basically translated it. It's in the Chinese sort of chronicles, and then it's been retranslated back. The other sources we have for the secret history are basically a number of Persian historians, particularly this gentleman known as Juveini, who travelled to Karakorum and actually is claimed to have seen it. So what we can do is compare these two different sources and see what they tell us about the early life of Genghis Khan. And you know, there's a sort of a, you know, they echo each other.
So just a couple of things, Ali, before we get started.
Sure.
So first of all, we are in, for those people who don't know, we are in the sort of the medieval period.
Yes.
We kick off in the 12th century and he dies in the 13th century.
That's
and
right.
He is the person who's the architect, the founding father of this kind of huge period of Mongol expansion, I guess.
That's right.
The most sort of rapid expansion probably in human history. Now, the second thing I was going to say is, you talked about his name, Genghis, but that's not his original name, right?
No, that's a title. It's an honorific. Yeah, it's an honorific. And you read various, I was always taught, I have to say, and I'm going to stick with this, that Genghis Khan actually means Lord of all those who dwell in felt tents. So this is an honorific that he gets in 1206 when he basically brings the Mongol Confederation, the tribes together, and begins the jolly of, you know, heading down into what is now China.
And just to be clear, his surname is not Khan.
No, not at all. Again, Lord. That's Lord. Yeah, Lord. Yeah. And it is one of the great banes, yes, that a lot of people tend to use Khan, because Khan is also a term that's used in Persian quite frequently just to mean Mr. these days. It's sort of slightly been diminished over the time. There's a lot of words that come in and seep in. But in those days, obviously, it means Lord.
But his real name is Temujin.
Temujin, blacksmith.
So he's Smith.
Yeah.
Before he becomes Khan, he's Mr. Smith.
Mr. Smith. Yeah, it's a fairly... I mean, the interesting thing about his rise, by the way, is that quite apart from the fact that, you know, what we know comes from essentially one source, and it's pretty vague and it's quite speculative, but it's not smooth is what the... I mean, you look at... So you would imagine the secret history is, on the whole, quite eulogistic. It obviously says, you know, what a splendid chap he was and, you know, how he outmaneuvered all his foes. But it has to be said that he had a pretty rough time growing up. I mean, it wasn't all easy.
So Ali, before we come to Genghis Khan himself, just the background. So the secret history says about the Mongols that they are descended from a deer and a blue-grey wolf.
Yes.
But there's a long line of descent that at some point there's a mysterious glowing man who appears through a tent. And he contributes to the bloodline of the Mongols. But they are basically, when Temujin is born into them, they're a fairly insignificant tribe on the Mongolian steppes.
Well, basically, I mean, the Mongols, yeah, there are a number of different tribes. I mean, basically on the, you know, what we consider to be the outer hinterland of the Chinese sort of imperium. What is now basically, I suppose, you know, Mongolia and that sort of outer areas, Siberia. And there are a number of different tribes who are basically, designated as a part of a sort of a Mongol confederation. I don't think you can devise them as one people. I mean, this is the interesting thing, is that what Temujin does is he basically welds them into a single group. He's not the first person to do it. I mean, there have been threats before and the Chinese deal with them in various ways, either through bribery or defeats and this sort of thing. What actually Temujin does, aka Genghis Khan, is basically not only wield them into a hole, if I can put it that way, but then ensure they have someone else to fight. I mean, that's the other thing. So he directs them elsewhere, and that keeps them all unified.
Just before we start on Temujin's actual career, the context for this. So you said that these are tribes who are nomadic. They live beyond the bounds of the Chinese Empire. So the Great Wall is basically, you know, the various incarnations of the Great Wall.
Various incarnations keep them out. Of it, yeah. It's not quite. Yeah.
And they belong to the steppes.
Yes.
Which are obviously not, you know, things that you go up if the lift's not working. They are
great
plains.
Great plains.
great grass plains.
They're kind of grasslands, aren't they?
Yeah. Yes. And they basically extend from the Pacific right the way up to Hungary.
Yes.
So this is the key thing to understand, isn't it, for the rise of the Mongols?
I mean, in ecological terms, yes. I mean, because basically they're nomads, they're on horseback, although we can discuss also the nature of their horses, by the way. They're not quite, you know, they're more ponies, actually. But nonetheless, you know, they need a particular environment in which to exist. So that is where they're most effective. And if you look at the expansion of the empire later, there is a sort of a slight correlation, obviously, about, you know, where the steppe ends and where they sort of stop expanding, basically.
And Ali, history is littered with examples, isn't it? Already, by the time that when Temujin is born, there have been tons of, I mean, the Avars, the Huns.
Yes.
There have been all these
the
people
Huns
who have
particular.
Swept, you know,
friends,
famously.
The Pechenegs,
friends of the show, the Cumans, all these kind of characters. That trajectory. So the story that we always tell about the Mongols and I mean, I can't help thinking of him as Genghis Khan.
Yeah, sure.
the way that the story is, you know, the storm from the east, come out of nowhere, all that.
Yeah.
But they don't really come out of nowhere because, I mean, this has been done a billion times before. Am I wrong about that?
No, it has been done. I think it hasn't been done quite on the scale that it's done on this occasion. That's the difference. And certainly, I mean, the interesting thing is the Chinese or the various, you know, Chinese authorities that we're dealing with, as China, as we know at this stage, is separated into separate kingdoms, but they have a particular modus operandi of dealing with these steppe tribesmen. I mean, and it's pretty effective, to be honest. That's the way they deal with it. And it's the same when you look at the Persian heartlands. They have a particular way of dealing with these sort of tribal hinterlands. The difference is that what Genghis Khan does is effectively transform this tribal confederation into, you know, you know, the most effective fighting force that I think people have actually experienced. And it is a shock. I mean, it's a major shock to the system. Although, as we'll see, you know, he learns on the way. I mean, he does. Right. He's very innovative, actually.
Okay, so he is born supposedly clutching a blood clot.
Yeah, good bit of secret history there. Yes,
which demonstrates that he is going to inherit universal rule. Apparently,
that's right.
I gather.
I can't believe that's a post facto invention, but yes.
And he's the son of a guy called Yusuke, is that right? Who's captured a Tartar chief, or killed a Tartar chief called Temujin. And when you capture someone, you take over everything. Yeah. So you take all their possessions, all their belongings, all their women, everything, and their name. So that's right. So he grows up, and His father is quite a significant figure.
He's a tribal leader. Relatively.
I mean, I wouldn't say. It depends what you mean by significant. I mean, he's obviously a sort of a clan. You know, a clan. Sort
he's
of
got people. To he's got order. People around. He's him. Got yeah, at his back.
But the sort of world, just to interrupt, the world that he lives in. They live in tents.
Yeah, yeah. It's all nomadic.
They live in a gur.
So again, please, Tom.
I thought it was a yurt, but anyway, yes.
No, I thought it was a yurt.
They have it at the Edinburgh Literary Festival. They have a gur.
Okay, and I've never heard anyone pronounce it. Yeah,
that's well, that's what they say. They say, "Welcome to the Edinburgh Little Felton. Do come into our gur."
I think that's just your misinterpreting the Scottish accent. Anyway, listen, they live in these tents and they move around. They're nomadic.
Yeah, yeah, they move around. I mean, it is nomadic. These are not, and this is crucial, actually, when it comes to their attitudes to cities, which I know we will be talking a little bit about their ecological attitudes. They don't like cities, and they think people who live in cities are decadent.
So and they don't like see peasants, do they? They don't like peasants, farmers. I mean, they kind of despise
They think that the only people they do like, interestingly, as you go on, are artisans, people who can actually do something for them. Yeah,
right.
So they do save them. I mean, again, that's one of the things that's quite striking. They will slaughter a city, but keep the artisans.
And Ali, I was intrigued to learn actors.
Actors?
Apparently, there were two rebel cities, and they spared the masons and the carpenters and the actors.
So you, with your John Wayne,
I'd be fine. I'd be fine, and I hope that the students.
By the way, I should point out
there is learning this as well.
There is a better film
by the Mongols.
There's a better film by Omar Sharif, just in case anyone was listening.
Okay,
we're going to take a quick break now, and then when we're back, let's talk about Temujin, the early years. See you in a sec. Welcome back to The Rest is History. And now, Dominic, where are we up to in the life of Temujin?
Temujin, he grows up. They have an arranged marriage. That's right, isn't it?
Yeah, he's, I think Borte is his
Borte,
main wife.
And
played by Susan Hayward in...
Get off the film. He's what, 9 years old when he's sent off to her...
But he's sent off in preparation for the marriage, basically. Right. So then when he reaches puberty, then he gets married.
And so off he goes. And in the meantime, his father... is poisoned by the Tatars.
He's poisoned.
Yeah.
Again, bear in mind, this is all secret history stuff. We have no idea whether any of this is true, but there's no reason not to believe
it. And just if it isn't true, is it conforming possibly to some formula, some expected formula of a kind of chief's
there is.
Life?
I mean, there are some tropes there. I mean, one of the things I found in the secret history, which is quite interesting, is that he's always got a very reverential attitude to his mother. I mean, you have to sort of think about that. You know, why is the world conquering Genghis Khan so fearful of his mother? There's a trope. I mean,
like
it's
Nero,
this idea that he's basically, you know, he has a...
Or Ted Heath.
Yes.
So there are tropes.
Conquerors of history. Yes. Yeah, so he's been paired up with his future wife, Borte, and also his childhood friend, Jamaka.
Yes.
Who becomes his blood brother. And so that's another key figure.
Yes,
so these are
absolutely two
key figures. And then as he gets older, basically, it's a succession of peoples who piss him off.
Yes.
So the first people that Dominic just mentioned are the Tatars, who they host his father, they give him food, but they've poisoned it, and he dies several days later. And Genghis Khan comes back to take over from his dad's position. And the Mongols say, go away. We're not interested in
you. Now, that's interesting. Why do you think they would reject him? Because he's been away and he's...
He's been away. He's probably too young. He's not seen as someone who can really sort of carry the can in a sense. So, I mean, you know, essentially it's a power play, isn't it? I mean, you've got to, I suppose, look at it in terms of tribal politics, which is sort of fairly common that, you know, he's not someone who either they particularly knew or cared for. That's the argument. But of course, it also fits the narrative of his very, you know, his struggle, actually, the struggle to achieve his, you know, his destiny. I mean, you know, you can see various novels coming out of that, but that's the, you know.
It is like a novel. I mean, it really is like a novel. It's, you know, the archetype of myth.
If you think about the great hero who suffers
and has to pull himself up.
He's born
up
with
nothing.
That clot of blood in his hand. So that's his destiny. He's constantly being, you know, I don't know, disinherited, shall we say. He's not, but he fights hard. And it is, you know, I mean, it is a hell of a fight. I mean, it's and there are periods in his early existence where we just absolutely don't know what happens to him. There's a sort of 10-year gap in the secret history. We just don't know where he is.
Well, once they reject him, they plunge him into poverty, don't they? Doesn't he live on kind of nuts and roots?
He lives on marmots. And that's something that the listeners should bear in mind, because marmots may well play a part later in the show. He's living on marmots and roots. He has a bust up with his elder half-brother, Bector, who he kills. So the evidence is stacking up. This is a guy you don't want to cross. And then he gets captured by, am I pronouncing this right? The Teuchid.
I would say the Teuchid.
But anyway, the
leader... Well, Mongolian listeners, please write in and let us know.
I know, yeah.
The leader of this people is called Kiriltuk. And he is known as the fat man, obviously, in Mongolian.
In Mongolian.
So he's kind of fatty. He's very large. And he is the guy who puts Temujin in a kind of portable stocks. So he becomes a kind of slave. And it's wearing the stocks, that brilliant passage that I read at the top of the show.
Was that what that was?
John Wayne?
That's John Wayne.
Impenetrable.
So, but he escapes, doesn't he? So that's a kind of dramatic moment.
I mean, the two striking things of his early life really are: one, that his wife gets kidnapped,
and so that's the third people who piss him off.
Yeah, yeah.
So we've had the Tatars, we've had the Teuchid, or whatever, however you pronounce them, and then the three Meerkats.
Yeah, the Meerkats.
It's not what?
The Meerkats. Meerkats are one of the tribes that really he has. Yeah.
Apparently means the wise ones, but it's impossible.
There's been an awful lot of wife stealing with them.
It's all about humiliation, and it's all about, you know, possession. And of course, you know, one of the things that happens is every time you defeat a rival sort of clan, let's call them clans rather than tribes, you acquire a wife. So you know, it's part of
that
marriage
clan.
Alliance. Yeah,
yeah.
So you build that. It's a kinship alliance. So he has an awful lot of wives.
But Borka has been kidnapped by the fat man.
Yeah.
And so he needs allies. So obviously he turns to his brother.
Jamuka.
But also he turns to a guy called Togrul, who is, and Dominic, do you know what Togrul is known as?
The thin man?
No, this is very exciting for members of the Discord, we've called them Wangs ever since the General Gordon episode.
Yeah.
Togrul was known as the Wang Khan.
The Wang Khan. Yeah,
so that's the king leader.
I think of you as a Wang Khan, Tom.
That's great, isn't it? I think we're the Wang Khans.
Anyway, right, let's...
So Jamuka, Wang Khan, the Wang Khan and Temujin get him back, get Burka back. And basically, Temujin by now he's showing kind of charisma.
Yeah, Berta.
Sorry, Berta. He's showing charisma. He's showing an ability to lead. He's showing an ability to kill his enemies, to steal their wives, take their horses.
He is no. I mean, he has now. The interesting thing about himself and Jamuka, who are the two rivals in this, is actually in a contest. You know, when they fall out, which is inevitably they always do, obviously, when they fall out, Jamuka actually defeats Temujin, and this is the period when he's down and out, so to speak. But Jamuka, interestingly enough, and you won't be surprised by this, doesn't actually win friends and influence people by taking, you know, of his rivals, boiling 70 of them alive, apparently. So, and by boiling 70 of them alive, people sort of think, oh, this guy's even a bit too savage for us. So that basically gives another opening to Temujin, basically, to come back against Jamuka. I mean, it's that dynamic in a sense that Jamuka is... is almost, I mean, this is quite interesting, is almost saying to Temujin that you're a bit too soft, you know.
Right. So Temujin is the kind of, he's the centrist, he's the liberal Democrat. Yeah. Of the
In a sense, Temujin is saying, you know, you've got to win friends and influence people, build a sort of a network. Jimuka's saying, you know, no, this is all namby-pamby stuff. You know, when you defeat your foes, you do it. And again, it's interesting that when Temujin, you know, when Temujin and Jimuka basically split and a number of people betray Jimuka and basically move to Temujin's side, Temujin doesn't like that. I mean, he basically says, you know, you have betrayed your lord and I'm not having anyone who's disloyal, you know, with me. So he actually has them executed as well. I mean, it's quite interesting how he develops a very clear sense of, you know, a loyalty network. And that's really quite distinctive about him. I mean, and the contrast with Jimuka is interesting in that
one respect. Question, Ali, before we press on with the narrative. So there's quite, it's quite odd, I would say, that Temujin has been, he's been very poor and he's been living on these marmots and nuts and stuff. Yeah. But he's nevertheless able to raise an army of thousands of men to defeat his enemies, you know, almost sort of out of nowhere. Now, is that because they respect his bloodline, or is it, or is there something that we're not being told in the source?
Well, I think there's something we're not being told in the sources. I mean, obviously they're playing up his weakness because it adds to the dramatic narrative of his reemergence. But I think it's also his bloodline, his charisma, and his ability to win the loyalty of people. If you look at some of the accounts, I mean, albeit of course the later accounts, even the Persian accounts, they sort of argue that, you know, he has a political mastery. I mean, he knows how to win people over, and they compare him, you know, with Alexander and people like that. You know, they sort of say he is the new, you know,
Khosrow,
the new Alexander, the new this. Yeah. Yeah, we don't want to talk too much about Alexander because, you know, obviously he's not a favorite of mine. But no. You know, it's
You should read a brilliant book, Ali. That will change your mind completely.
I have. I want you to know that I have.
Isn't it also a reflection of the fact that the tribes are very vociferous, that they split apart, that then they congeal again. And so therefore, if you have, I mean, essentially, if you snooze, you lose. But equally, there's potential there, if you're very charismatic and skillful, for you to rise from absolutely nowhere.
That's right.
You know, if you start to gather a few people around you, then exponentially, you'll start to get more and more. And if you can keep going, if you can absolutely, I mean, it's kind of like a computer game, if you can get to level 36, then you've got all the tribes underneath you.
Well, I mean, the key element here is also this notion of blood brother, by the way. I mean, so what he does, previous sort of like Jimuka and others, focus very, very much on the sort of kinship ties of their various clans and tribes and so on and so forth. What Temujin does actually is he brings different groups together and he creates blood brothers. And, you know, he almost invents relationships. So people say that, you know, the one of the secrets of his success is not to spend too much time thinking about kinship, you know, loyalties. It's about, yeah, I mean, they use the term meritocracy. I think it's a bit much, but nonetheless, he's promoting people or bringing people towards him on the basis of what they can do and their abilities. And of course, what that means is that you're naturally, you know, if people think that by siding with Temujin, you're certainly not going to be boiled in a vat of water or whatever, mm-hmm. or a vat of oil, for, you know, there's an attraction to, you know, there's some benefit to that. And then he can turn their loyalty to other uses. So you're quite right about sort of building that momentum, and he keeps that momentum up by building different links. So what you find is also in the military organization that he builds, which is based on a sort of a decimal system, by the way. I mean, it's very sort of, he essentially creates new groupings. You know, he brings people together.
How do you
together.
Mean based on a decimal
so
system?
So basically the standard Mongol military unit is the 10,000, the tuman, which is another term that is very current in modern Persian, has to be said. The tuman is 10,000 soldiers, but it goes from 10 to 100 to 1,000. Hazara, the Hazaras in Afghanistan, right? The Hazaras, the 1,000. And they are designated in this, you know, they're organized in these groups. And often old tribal loyalties are ignored in this. You see, they're brought together in different, you see what I mean?
I have a question.
Sure.
About that. So that, you know who that reminds me of that we've done in the show? Is Muhammad.
Not Alexander.
No, it's Muhammad. Oh. So he takes a people that have previously been feuding tribal loyalties, and he forges something new. Yeah. He's a great political innovator. Yeah. Is that the same? Do you think there is a sort of slight parallel?
There have been, yeah. I mean, there is a similarity there. And of course, the other thing is to bear in mind that the Mongols, far from being, you know, there is an argument whether they're purely shamanistic or, you know, and sort of, actually there is this sort of idea of the great sky god Tengri. So it's this notion that they do have some sort of spiritual belief. It's not quite as, I mean, I know people then say, oh, the Mongols are very liberal when it comes to religions. It's not that they're liberal. They don't care. I mean, that's mainly, they don't give a hoot, you know, who you, right. what you believe in, as long as you pay your taxes. So that's the difference, really. But there is a sort of a spiritual element to it.
Right.
Not the Christian, question, you'll be pleased to know.
Very pleased to hear that. Yeah. I'm glad that we can put that out of this podcast completely. Now, the second thing I was going to say was, so when Muhammad and, you know, the Arab conquest happened, I mean, one reason that historians say for that is, they say, well, it's partly because the neighbors are weak, but it's also because there's been all kinds of kind of technological and political crossover from their neighbors to prepare the ground before that. Yeah. Is that also happening in the world that young Temujin is growing up? So are they getting lots of new stuff from China, or are there lots of contacts that weren't there before, or is it a kind of unchanging world?
Well, I mean, that's an interesting question, because actually one of the things that the Mongols are bad at to begin with is siege warfare. So when they start their conquest of China, they're not actually very good at taking cities, to be honest.
Right.
It's only after their diversion into the Islamic lands, the Khwarizm Shahs, you know, the what is now in Persia, that they then collect all these artisan and siege workers and then go back to China. I mean, they do sack certain cities, but their conquest of China becomes somewhat more systematic once they pick up all the sort of siege capability. So it is interesting that initially they're not very good, you know, right. at dealing with...
Ali, is it not the case? I mean, they have the composite bow, which is absolutely devastating weapon.
Yes.
I mean, it fires arrows faster and more lethal effect than, say, the longbow.
Yes.
And you can fire it from a horse and they grow up. And that makes them an absolutely lethal force.
It's a mobile
platform. There is the argument, isn't there, that Genghis Khan launches his campaigns basically just in the nick of time, because it's just before the arrival of gunpowder.
Oh, yes. Yes, absolutely. So, yes.
You know, a few more decades.
Yes.
They wouldn't have been able to do it because gunpowder would have put paid to them.
Although, I mean, of course, you know, the composite bow is probably a much more effective weapon than the early musket. I mean, it's just a question of who can use it. To be able to use the composite bow on horseback requires years of training, obviously. You don't need if you're using the musket. So that's absolutely right. I mean, the gunpowder empires really put an end to the nomad, you know. But those first muskets,
as you say, Ali, I mean, they're more likely to go off in your face, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah.
I suppose it's got a tiny bit longer than...
And the Mongols use it. I mean, they do use gunpowder.
Yeah, they do. They do, don't they?
Partly for show, but yeah.
Well, they're the first to use it in Europe, I gather. Anyway, so I think let's just finish the account of how... Temujin becomes Genghis Khan.
Right.
So we've been talking about Jamukha.
Yeah.
This blood brother who's turned into his kind of enemy and who boils people alive.
Yeah.
They have a final bust up, don't they?
Yeah.
And the Wang Khan is also involved in that. The Wang Khan has also turned against Temujin.
Yeah.
He gets defeated by Temujin, and then Jamukha gets handed over by his own men, basically.
That's right.
Am I right that Temujin basically says, because you're my blood brother, I will spare you?
Yes. Yes.
And Jamukha says, no, kill me.
Well, he says there isn't room for two suns in the sky.
Yeah, that's right.
We're not going to have this. But again, it's interesting. The point you make there is, again, quite interesting and a bit of an insight into Temujin's charisma, in a sense, that Jamukha's own men hand him over. I mean, it's quite, you know, they decide, we know who's on the up here.
So again, his political skills, isn't it, rather than just martial prowess?
Yes, absolutely. And I mean, I think one of the things we need to get away from is really this notion that the Mongols are purely military achievement. I mean, they're quite politically savvy, actually, in what they do. And so what he says, you're my blood brother, I'd much rather sort of be with you. And whatever Jamukha says, absolutely, you know, there can't be two suns in the sky. But he says, the only thing is, you know, execute me, but I don't shed my blood. I mean, this is the thing. So it's again something that's quite common, has to be said, that you don't shed basically royal blood.
How do they kill him?
So they put him on I think they break his back on a wheel. I mean, it's a sort of a wheel thing, and they break his back. Yeah,
that's not a good way to go.
The other ways that we'll see later, if you see, is, you know, obviously in the Middle East, there's one of the famous ones is wrapping the caliph up in a carpet and trampling him to death.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's to make, I mean, I'm not sure what that means. He doesn't bleed, by the way, but maybe you don't see it. It's not. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. So that 1206.
Yeah.
Jamukha is killed.
He's then declared, Genghis Khan, Lord of all who dwell in felt tents. And that's really the pivotal. He is now in charge of the Mongol Confederacy. He has this huge military potential. You know, he's politically top dog. Now, what most Chinese and other observers say is now's the time when they start fighting each other and it all dissipates. But not in this case, basically.
Right.
A coiled spring.
Exactly.
Right. I think we should leave it here for today, but we will be back tomorrow with Ali Ansari and Chinggis Khan. We will launch the Mongol conquests and see what Genghis Chinggis does next. See you tomorrow.